We're chatting to someone now on the Guide Liverpool that we all know in this city, across Merseyside. We've all been inspired by this person, and I know she won't like me saying that. Her name is Dominique Walker, and we got to know her back in 2005 for the wrong reasons. But since then, the kind of positivity and the way this story has evolved into something so special is really quite incredible. So we're going to talk to her about that, but also about a brand new campaign which has been launched this week. Dominique, first off, thank you for joining us. How is lockdown treating you in your household at the moment?
You know what? It's okay. It's an adjustment. Let's just say that it's an adjustment. But you know what? I suppose in everything, for me, I try and attribute some things I'm actually grateful for. So I'm actually grateful that I've got two parks on my doorstep. I'm grateful that I've got a back garden. I've got a car, a nice house. Do you know what I mean? I've got an office space. And my kids are healthy. My mum and you know, my siblings are all healthy. So I try and be and almost practice some form of gratitude in the madness that is COVID-19, and like I said, it being almost a super suicide mission to go to Lidl. Do you know what I mean? It's insane. But I try and focus on the things that I suppose that I can control, and the things that I can control is like watching the footy and like laughing at like Liverpool getting beaten that.
Don't be laughing at that down in front of me, Dominique.
You know how the mighty have fallen. That's not a good starting point. But I just need to make it, you know, abundantly clear that for me, as an Arsenal fan and a closet Evertonian, is that it warms my heart that Liverpool are struggling at the moment. And I just think I just need to make that abundantly clear.
Can I just make clear we've got a really good edit button on the Guide Liverpool as well. Nice pair of scissors to chop right through this interview.
And then you'll just lie and I'll turn up next time and I'll have my Arsenal shirt on.
Listen, let's talk about what's happening now. Obviously, we're going to talk about Anthony. We're going to talk about the foundation. Let's start straight off with this campaign because it's really important. I was really shocked reading these figures. 105,000, more than 105,000 reports of hate crimes in the year ending March 2020. They're really big numbers considering how much work has been done. That must be really frustrating for you to see that, Dominique.
You know what, for me, it is frustrating. 160% increase in relation to hate crime. Part of it, obviously, is people know that they can report things. They can report things directly to the foundation. They can report things to third-party reporting centres right across the city. They also know that they can report things online and so on and so forth. Because obviously, we're in time of COVID, and they know that the police, in relation to things that could have happened, you know, with their neighbours or with or online, or even when they're at the Lidl trying to get the £10 gin, that things obviously happen. So I think people know that they can report things, and it'll be taken obviously serious. I think part of it is also the situation that we're in now, where articulations, understandings about race, about racism, about unfairness in relation to inequalities in terms of race and class and so on and so forth are all at the forefront, and we're having these conversations. So people will, if you hate me because of something that I can't change, I can't rub off my identity, people now I feel are more empowered to be like, you know what, I'm actually going to report this and follow this through. So I think it's responsive of the impact, obviously, of the situation that we're in terms of C19, I think it's part of the causes and the legacies in terms of race and racism within this country. And then it's part of the responses that the police have as well in relation to actually definitively responding to hate crime as well, which I know as somebody who worked in the hate crime department, that they'll be doing above and beyond in relation to the victims who were suffering, but also there's community organisations like ourselves, like Daisy UK, like CAB, who deal with LGBT issues as well. You'll be working overtime in relation to that as well. So I think it's twofold in relation to the figures. And I think we need to continue to have conversations and articulations about race and be comfortable. If it makes you know, uncomfortable to start to talk about race, then for me in the work that I do, we're making inroads, because that means I've touched you here. You know, I've made you think about it up here and almost decentered all the things that are going on about you and made it about something outside of yourself, you know, because I think we don't have articulations and understandings about our identities. We don't do that work. We don't do that interpersonal work. We don't do the work in relation to our own emotions and where we belong, our sense of family and friendship and love. We don't really do those things. And I've found from my 15 years, 16 years of doing this work, is that I've been completely immersed in it. Completely immersed in it to the point where we've had to definitively change a lot of the things that AWF does in relation to the responses for hate crime, for hate crime victims. And for it not to just be that I'm a victim. I'm not a victim. I'm a victim's sibling. Like, my brother was killed. I'm still definitively here as a survivor. So for me to undertake that mantra, I say, is more powerful than me sort of lying down and just saying, well, I'm just going to suffer now. Because that's not within my culture. It's not within Scouse culture. It's not within Jamaican culture. It's just not. It's not what I'm used to. And it's definitively, it's weird that for me, and people don't do this in terms of race. When I think of Jamaicanness and me being Jamaican and some of the things that we prescribe to in our culture, some of it, quite a lot of it, especially like, for example, the matriarch. So your mum, your nan, is usually in Scouse culture, is the head of the household. Your dad, yeah, he does whatever needs to be done, but your mum is the centre of that.
Yeah, and your nan is the boss.
Yeah, yeah. That's kind of, for me, that is kind of, that's Jamaican. That's Jamaican heritage. So for me, when I'm talking to my Scouse, you know, my family and friends who live here, and me obviously living here, my family and friends, and I see, I'm just like, well, there's a lot of similarities, and we should celebrate a lot of our differences and almost use those differences definitively to make changes on how we see things and how we do things. But we're not ready to have those conversations and also those quite deep and sometimes hurtful and painful conversations when we start to think of race, when we start to think of how we've treated people who are different, when we start to do some of that, you know, inner work. That's how we make change. That's how things change. And we see our, even though, yes, visually, this is different. It's not racist for you to see that I'm black. I am black, been black for 35 years. It's not going to change. I'm not going to wake up tomorrow and it's not going to change. It's going to stay. And I'm completely happy and definitive and proud in that. But we need to recognize some of the differences and the ways that, yes, I have to be treated differently because of my race and because I'm a woman and because my daughter has a disability. I have to be treated sometimes differently because of that. But ultimately, there are a lot of things that I don't need to be treated differently, you know, because of, and we can almost find comparisons in relation to that. So, for example, I'm a lecturer at John Moores University, so I don't need your money. Do you know what I mean? I'm not to big it, but I'm sound. Like, I don't need that type of definitive economic support. It'd be nice, but I'm okay. So I don't need that sort of support. But I know a lot of ethnic minorities, a lot of white working class, black working class, brown working class families need that support as well. And that was a long way of saying basically that in terms of hate crime, the responses basically are reciprocal of what's going on in society. That was a long way of saying it.
Well, it was a good way of saying it. you mentioned there about discussions and conversations, and
yeah.
I think in Britain this has always been the case that it's we're not as open and as honest and as able to have difficult conversations as easy as some other countries. It's always been that kind of British way. Mm-hmm. Personally, for me, I felt after George Floyd last year that got a little bit easier.
Yeah,
let's use this as an example. I would always think, oh my God, I love that girl's hair. I want to ask her about her hair, but then I can't because she's black. I can't ask her about that because that might be racist. but you absolutely can, and that's what it's about. It's about being normal, isn't it? It's about openly discussing what you want to discuss and talk about.
Like, you know, mayor's purple, I would say don't touch it because that's a bit weird, but it's weird. It's completely weird. But
it is weird,
It is to I want to touch it. No, I'm like, it's the same as you. But it's fine for us to have a conversation. Don't wait to get your ear done. Well, let me tell you this. And that. Do you know what I mean? It's fine for us to have those conversations and those articulations and understandings of difference. It's fine for us to do that. It's when we attribute the negative to those differences. Yeah. But even in saying that, we need to understand where those negative things come from. Yeah, we need to understand where those processes, where those thoughts, where those spillages, I call them, where those things are definitively come from. And you can only do that type of work by looking at yourself, your identity, who formed your identity, who formed your understandings about Black people. What informed your understandings about Black people? Was it the media? Was it your mum? Was it your dad? Was it your friends? Blah, blah, blah. When was the first time you met a Black person? Do you know what I mean? When we start to, and this is not, you know, you go up to your Black friend and go, oh, you know what, lads, can we? No.
When we have this conversation.
Yeah. And unless you've got friends who can have, like me, and because I'm a lecturer and because I'm a sociologist, I can do this, you know, and I do this with my friends. But, you know, you do this yourself. This is in a way, in order to be actively anti-racist, it takes for you to actually do something. It's a verb. It's a doing word. You have to do something. And part of this unconscious state that we find ourselves in relation to race and not being able to see how other people are treated and how other people navigate life is part of it. And you can only start to do that type of work when you start to do that work on yourself. The key to well-being is understanding who you are, your positioning, and why you think a certain way. And I was looking at a study. I was doing some training on unconscious bias the other day, and unconscious bias training is not anti-racism training. It's not the same, completely different. But what unconscious bias training does is it teaches you the sort of science in relation to the way that we categorize people. And what this one, there was a study from the University of Toronto, and it was a Dr. Kang, I think his name was, basically found that we form our understandings in relation to racial bias. So the biases that we have in relation to race, so you see myself as Black, most of them are formed between 6 to 9 months. So the things that your parents will articulate about race, the people that you're around, your understandings of race, your understandings of difference, are largely formed by the time you're one. So when we start to think,
how's that possible though when you're so young? Because there's also that conversation that many people have. You mm-hmm. see kids playing in a playground. Racism doesn't exist until it's drilled into them. Isn't one a bit young for that? Or
see, for me, right, when I think of my kids, right, and I think of my kids and their interactions with other kids, there have been times when my kids have been raised around different. So they've been raised around white people, Black people, Asian people, white people, people of different sexualities, people of different disabilities as well, and also all the interlinked in relations. Because my kids have been raised around difference, my two don't see that. They don't, because they've been raised in it. But I'll give you an example. I went to a farm in the Lakes with my daughter. My daughter at the time was 4. And my daughter was running around doing what kids do. She was everywhere, pulling things and doing whatever. Another little girl and her mum come into the little play area. I just saw the little girl looked at my daughter, and she was 4, and she stared at her and kept staring and watching her. And I looked at the mum, and the mum looked at me and was like, she's never seen a Black kid before. And I says, I said to her, you don't have to explain, but I says, you are going to have to talk to her about it. So she, because I says, me and her, we just had a conversation two months, as you do on the playground.
Yeah.
And I said to her, I says, you have to show her that. And I says, I don't have to do this, but I said, you need to show her that my daughter is something that she's someone that she can play with as a friend. Yeah. You know, you need to be, and I said that to her, and she was like, you know, I've never had these conversations before. No one's ever said anything like this to me. And I says, well, because people will be, you're probably frightened to think that it's right, and you're having to explain, and yeah, we're having these. But I says, it's safe for us to have these conversations. We're both mums. Our kids are the same age. They can play. And then my mate who I was with, her son's white, and my friend was white. And then the little girl watched my daughter and my friend's son play together, white and black, and they were just playing, rolling around and doing whatever. And then the little girl, you know, obviously she looked to mum, and mum was like, yeah, it's out, and she went and played. So we can't...
Yeah, I love that story, though.
Yeah, and it's dead simple, isn't it? Yeah. And for me, when... because I grew up in Heighton, so I grew up in a predominantly white area, I've always had to be conscious of the space. I've had to be conscious in terms of danger. I've had to be conscious of the way that I inhabit areas and spaces that I go into. I have to be. I've always had to be, always, like from about two. I've always had to be. And I've always had to be for a number of different reasons, for safety, to protect my siblings, to also to know who I'd play with and who wouldn't. And I've always had to have a definitive understanding of race in relation to the space that I take up, and also to the negative things that people will put on me before I've even done anything, you know? We have to ask ourselves why white people don't have to do the same. And it's that unconscious state where we find ourselves now in 2020, where we're having these conversations about race. And it's not, these are, even for me, talking, and I use my daughter as an example, it's painful for me to watch my daughter not be played with simply because, simply because she's black. That's painful to me.
Of course it is.
But also, equally, what I thought was, my daughter's boss. Like, she's funny. She's articulate. She's a little ball of energy. She's like a Tasmanian devil. That's my daughter. And I thought, your daughter's missing out on that as well, you know? I did feel sorry for the mum. I shouldn't have, because I should have just been like, what are you talking? But it's never been my way. It's always to have that dialogue and to talk about these different things in order for us to move forward. And I can hope that next time that little girl, I can, hope and, pray that the next time that little girl played with someone, it wouldn't even fake, because it'd just be like, oh, it's another kid, you know? And I think this is part of the destruction. Yeah. This is part
this
of
is the important thing that needs this is, to happen yeah, now.
This is the, and this is what I'm saying in relation to kids. Yes, kids are innocent. and yes, kids will not all the time put negative associations in relation to race, gender, disability, and so on and so forth, but they do see it. They do see difference, don't lie. They do, and it's studied, and there's a bunch of studies you see. They do, and you can see it. I know there's for me, there's loads of times, like, you'd be walking around Tesco and you'll see little babies and stuff like that. And usually, nine times out of ten, you can tell the babies who've been around people who obviously look and a little bit different, because you get like a little cheeky smile, or you get one who look at you and you'd be like, "How are these little?" And you can tell.
Yeah. So it is there.
Yeah, it is, and I think it's for us, obviously, as adults, to be conscious and to have those conversations with our children about difference. And for it not to be uncomfortable, it's just, yeah, there's people who are black, there's people who are Asian, there's people who are different to yourself. There's not everybody looks like you, not everybody in this, there's difference. And I think once we start to have those conversations, it makes it easier for the adult.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when you come to meet me and I start to reel off statistics in relation to how ethnic minority communities are treated in the country, and when I link policing in some ways in terms of history to imperialism, and when I start to reel some of that stuff off, you're not thrown off your chair and be like, yeah, what? Why is she saying all these things? Why is she why is she lying? I'm like, no, it's in a book. I read it in a book.
Dominique, I'm talking to you now, and you know, I've met you before. I don't know if you remember, and I've never spoke to you properly like this. You are such a character, and you everything you say, you're kind of drawn to, but you've obviously got a real, real strong passion for what you're talking about as well.
Yeah.
Obviously started when Anthony was killed.
Yeah.
Do you see, we watched that program last year, the fantastic program about Anthony and what he'd be doing now. Yeah. What would you be doing now? Do you think you'd be doing this? Because I actually do, if I'm really honest. Just watching you today and speaking to you, do you think you would have followed that same path into law, into justice?
Do you want me to be dead honest with you?
Yeah.
Right. You see the work that we do with the Anthony Walker Foundation? That is Anthony's work. So what we are continuing, and I'm going to be dead straight with you, what we are continuing was the work that Anthony started. So our Anthony was a youth worker. He worked within the church and worked with all kids of all different ethnicities and all different identities. He also did basketball. So he coached the younger kids. And taught them about basketball and so on, and then he played for a team, and his team was all different, and again moved from Heighton, but his dad lived in Toxteth, so his mates were from all over and stuff like that. Our Acne encompassed a spirit of community and encompassed the spirit of helping others that not even I and I'll be completely honest with you, in terms of the work that I did back then, so 18, 19 and 20, was going out, going raving, going dancing.
I think that's where I met you, actually.
Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Also, I wanted to be a producer. I wanted to be in media. I wanted to make films about like Black life in the UK. So I thought, my first job was at ITV. So I come out of uni and I went to ITV just after our auntie died in 2005. It was a couple of years after that. So I think, for me, in relation to would I be doing it, I think I would have been a producer of some description. So I probably would have been like Steve McQueen, because I when I come out of uni, I was on a Black Asian Minority Ethnic trainee researcher scheme. Now, everybody that went on that, like my mate's a commissioner for Channel 4, my other mate's like head of entertainment at, you know, a production, you know, they've all done really well. So I know if our acne wouldn't have died, I'd be in media right now. So I'd be working alongside my mate who basically like runs, like he does like all the entertainment stuff, like Edinburgh Festival and all that. He does all of that. And he set up like an organization that helps in terms of diversity and inclusion in media. I would help him to do a lot of that stuff. But I don't know if I would definitively have been doing and being immersed. I probably wouldn't have joined the police, if I'm completely honest. I wouldn't have been as immersed in trying to help people. I'm being completely honest with you, my community, because I wanted to make films in order for the films and the documentaries that I made to speak for me, so I didn't have to be at the forefront. Because even though I'm quite articulate, I'm quite a homebody. I'm quite introverted. I like my space and my books. And if I could show you my bookshelf, I've got bookshelves. I'll just sit with a book and I'm dead happy. And I'll go out and dance and stuff like that. But I'll dance on my own. I'm quite happy with my own company. So when I think of our acne, the foundation is an extension of the work that he started. And all I've done, and he always said to me, he was like, "You're gonna work for me one day." And I was like, "Lad." I says, "I'm going to be a producer. I'm going to be like, I says, I'm going to be like Andy Peters or something."
He was like, "Broom cupboard."
Yeah. And he was like, "No," he says, "you're going to work for me." So I was like, "All right, yeah, Sam, whatever. Do you know what I mean? Whatever. It is what it is, isn't it?" So I think he wanted to be the lawyer. He had the interest in social justice. He had the interest in anti-racism. And I had an understanding of those things. And that came more to the forefront when I went to uni and I did like a course on Black Atlantic, and like my lecturer gave me Malcolm X's book and I was just like, what is this? And that started me on a sort of path in relation to sort of like Black Feminist for Black Critical Social Theory, anti-racism, but a lot of the definitive work of the foundation and the community side and helping and supporting people and embracing diversity and being actively anti-racist. That was Anthony's bag. And I'm just carrying on the things that I know if he was here, he'd definitively be doing. And for me, he was he was always better than me. Like, and I know you like people are like, oh, you're chatting. He was like, I'm just I suppose what I'm trying to do is to fulfill some of the things I know that he would have wanted definitively for us to make change. I know that he would have wanted me to continue to support my mum and everything that she's doing. But I also know because of the type of person that he was, is that he'd want to make Liverpool safer for everybody. And that was like Anthony, he never wished harm on anybody. He was like a good person. I'm a bit mad. I'm a good person, but I'm a bit. I know. Do you know what I mean? I'm just a bit in that respect. Whereas Anthony was definitively, he was a good man. He was a good brother. Would have been, well, he is a good uncle, even though he only met like my eldest, and my nephew, and there's like another eight of them who've now come, who've obviously never met him, but. Our Anthony was the best of us in my family. And I hope my family don't mind me saying this, but he was the best of us. And it's his birthday Sunday, and it's hard to say. But it's, I don't know, it's shit. It's like proper shit.
You know, you said then, you said he wanted to change things for the better and he wanted to change Liverpool for the better.
Yeah.
You understand as a sister and as someone who's worked so hard that he's done that. He's actually really done that.
Yeah.
He might not be here in person, but so many of us see that and see his face and quickly go, wow, that's the kid that changed everything. That's the kid that started to change things. Do you understand that as a sister?
Yeah, I do now. I didn't a couple of years ago, because I was doing so much of the work, I couldn't see sort of the benefits in relation to people. But once I sort of moved from being like project worker within the foundation, moved to a trustee role, and started to oversee a lot of the strategy and action plan that we have in relation to the foundation and what we do and oversee. And then obviously, because I was obviously a police officer as well, I'd see the other side and would deal directly with the victims. And then we would come in with the foundation almost as like the white hats and the super cape sort of thing. So I could definitively see the work of Anthony in action. Like, it's love for me, it's love in action. Like, I've, when I think of some of the things that the foundation has done, so it's like help people to find better accommodation, it supported people who were, you know, victims of, you know, intense ongoing hate crime, racism, identity-based issues, you know, homophobia, sexism, and so on and so forth. When I think of the support that the team has offered people direct, I'm talking about like face-to-face, going out, continuing relationships, having interpersonal relationships with victims, and even myself, like helping people from when they've reported it till after, and it continues, like they become your family. When I've been able to see some of that, the direct impact in terms of change. I'd love my brother to be here to see it because it's his work, but equally, in a roundabout way, and most people aren't spiritual, it's, for me, it's, there's a purpose in everything, and it's so painful. Yeah, but it's for me, I think when people interact with the foundation, they have to understand that this is almost like an outpouring of love from my family, because we didn't have to do it. We could have just been like, you know what, like, F this, like, we're just we're going to go and live in the lakes and swerve all this, and we don't have to help anybody, we don't have to try and check, we don't have to forgive anybody, we don't have to, don't even have to speak to anybody, we don't have to engage with the media, we don't have to do none of this. But because that's not inherently part of my culture, it's not inherently part of me being Black or Jamaican or a Christian or a Scouser, it would be, I'd be turning on who I'm essentially destined to be. So I think for me, in terms of the foundation and what we do, we transform things for people, and I've seen it. I think in the last 5 years, we've worked with about 40,000 young people wow. in education and outreach programs. And in terms of hate crime, like I said, 160% increase, like over the last year, because of C19 and the situations that we've been in, and obviously the tragic death of George Floyd. But we've supported about 5,000 people. And then we sit on loads of the strategic, local strategic initiatives in relation to hate crime as well. And then we deliver the hate crime service for the city. And we've done that since, oh God, like the last 5 years.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, and then I think, you know, when you started and I said, you said, obviously you don't realise how pivotal you've been in relation to change in this city. Now I think that I've left Merseyside Police and I don't do that work every day, I now realise a massive impact that me being within Merseyside Police and then bringing and helping to support a hate crime service that supports victims whilst also investigating the crime. It's mental.
But that's the inspirational side, Dominique, that I was saying. And it's weird when you're on that path. And, you know, you're going day by day. You're a mum as well. And you're mad busy doing what you're doing. It's easy to forget that, isn't it? And you should take heed sometimes and stop and think about what you've actually achieved and what you've done. I just want to talk about your mum, Dominique. I hope you don't mind.
No.
It's a weird, weird thing. And I was thinking about this morning. Whenever anyone does me wrong, and I think, fuck you, and I'm really, really pissed off with someone,
yeah.
I always think of your mum. And it's the weirdest thing, because I always remember when I worked at Radio City, your mum come and done an interview with us, and it was about the time she spoke heavily about forgiveness.
Yeah.
And that really stuck with me, how your mum could forgive after what happened to Anthony. And I know it's completely different. You know, you pissed off with your mate, you forgive them, whatever. It's a completely different scenario, but it made people go, whoa, if G Walker can do that, then anyone can.
Yeah.
Is she kind of stood by her guns with that? Is she still very much kind of got that forgiveness side of her persona? I can imagine that she has. And how did you feel when she put that out there?
You know what? My mum, like, I don't, again, right, and I'll go back to culture. Within Caribbean culture, so being Jamaican, we're not, as we'd say, like, showy. We're not, they call it fussy. We're quite modest. Let me English, you know, we're quite modest in that respect. And for me, my mum is as close as you can get to somebody who definitively walks, you know, a Christian mindset, faith, an encompassment of almost Christ, and it not to compare, not in any way, because obviously, you know, Jesus is Jesus and in that respect, and God is God in that respect. But in terms of, like, if we list the sins, me ma, you can't tick none of them off. Do you know what I mean? Like, you can't, like, she doesn't swear, she doesn't drink, she hasn't got tattoos, and I've got, do you know, she, you know what I mean? She didn't rave when she was younger. She, you know, she stayed faithful to her husband. Do you know what I mean? She is the epitome of, when you say something, you do it. When you know, she reads biblical scriptures, so, you know, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. You know, in that respect, you know, when she says 70 times 7 that we must forgive and we must do those things, she actually meant those things. and to be that grounded in faith for a lot of people today in 2021 is mind-blowing, because life will throw curveballs, life will throw all kinds of unspeakable things at you, grief, death, jealousy, domestic violence, hate crime, racism, will throw all these things at you. And it's easier to hate. It's easier to foster resentment. It's easier to not forgive. It's easier for you to just go, you know what? This has happened. This is the most traumatic thing that's happened to me. And you know what? I'm going to sit in this, and just, this is where I live now. And for some people, in terms of their life journey, if that's what you do in order for you to cope, I won't judge you for that. You know, it's not for me to judge. I mean, mum wouldn't judge you for that. But for the other people who think, you know what? Yes, this unspeakable horror did happen, but in spite of that, I'm not going to let that control me. And what I'm going to do is to love and to live. You choose life, the cliche. If you know what I mean? That in itself is speaking a truth, obviously, to yourself. It's walking a path where you turn your words into action. And ultimately, it's choosing you. It's like choosing yourself above all else. And for me, I never, like, my mum chooses to forgive, and I chose to forgive as well. And to be fair, if we get the chronological story right in relation to all that, I actually said it before she did.
I knew you were going to say that then.
I did. I said, and to be fair, it's because she didn't speak for 2 weeks. Yeah, she was traumatized. My ma didn't speak for... Yeah. She didn't speak to no press, nothing. She didn't do nothing. All the TV in those early days, and I'll shoot me out, was me. It was me. That's who you saw. It was me. I was the spokesperson. My mum couldn't speak. My dad couldn't speak. They didn't. My mum didn't speak a word for about 2 weeks. I'm not, nothing, nothing. She wouldn't speak to anybody. She just locked herself in her room. She didn't speak to nobody. And then when we eventually got the names of the people, and I remember I went to her and I said, listen, I was like, we know who did it. I says, you know, and I said, we've took the names to the police. So I says, you know, they'll find you who did it and they'll go to prison. And then she was like, all right. And I think that was like one of the first times she went away and was with her friends, and she didn't speak to, I didn't have a mum for about, oh God, about a year, I'd say. And she won't have the memory because she was in a whirlwind of grief. But I remember I went to the park, and the reporter, Mike, he was from Sky, always remember Mike, and he asked me, he said, oh, you know, you're a Christian family, do you find it in your heart to forgive? And I said, at that moment, I was, and it was a weird moment, because I thought, what a strange question to ask me, you know, my brother just died. And then I remembered what my mum said, it was similar to you, and I remember what my mum always said from when we were young. She was like, you know, you if you do something wrong, you apologise, we do forgive. You know, the Bible says 70 times 7 that we must forgive, and that's what Jesus said that we must do. I know it's not an easy road to have. And a couple of weeks before that, my mum was teaching, and we had like a woman's group within the church, and my mum was teaching us about forgiveness, and she was speaking in that time about, you know, unspeakable things happen to people all the time, every day. And she was like, you have to choose yourself in those things. You have to find the forgiveness, that Christ forgiveness, she would call it, and wear it every day, because it's not something that just comes. You know, I've been getting those lessons, and my mum was my Sunday school teacher. So I've been getting those lessons from birth, before I was born. So for me to be able to say and to reiterate the words of Christ and me being a Christian was dead easy, because that's how I've been, some would say, indoctrinated, but it's the way that I've been trained. Yeah. That's the way I've been brought up by my mum. And again, I'm going back to our matriarch. My mum and my nan were the matriarch in our family, and what they said, my granddad was Muslim, but what they said in terms of the Christian faith and us all going to church, that's what we did, and that's what we lived. So for me, Forgiveness is a process. It is not for everybody. It's we shouldn't be judged. I think in relation to hate crimes and racism, when an incident like that happens to somebody, the media shouldn't be quick to almost get those type of responses in order for it to be like, oh, you know what, they're not going to rise up and do things. But no, there should be a conversation that enables us to discuss about why the notion of forgiveness is needed when an injustice is done. So what do we do in relation to this injustice, and how do we create structures within society that will stop racisms as we see them, you know, that are both individual, structural, cultural, and so on and so forth. How do we, do you know what I mean? But we're not, we just want the soundbite.
Yeah, that's all it is, isn't it? With a lot of
and when we start to do the psychology of it, when we start to assess, and yes, for me, I am a better person for it. It's not that I don't get angry and I don't have feelings and emotions. Of course I do. That'd be ridiculous for me to say that. But I'm not, I see them as visitors. You know, they come and go, and I'm not circumnavigated by the different feelings that come over to me. And that's not to say that what happened to our Aunty was not the destruction of my family, because in a lot of ways it completely was. And that's me being completely honest. My dad never recovered.
Does it ever get any easier, Dominique? It's coming up to Anthony's birthday this Sunday. The birthdays and things, do they get easier? How is it now for you, for your mum, for the family?
You learn how to cope. And I think what I said before is I'm not the victim. I'm a victim's sibling. So I get to live and do all the, you know, buy a BMW. I get to do those things. Our auntie doesn't. So our focus for me obviously should be on supporting people and supporting our community and being actively anti-racist in everything, so people don't die. Black bodies, black people don't die, Asian people don't die, and also white people don't die at the hands of racism. But for me, in terms of Aunt Anthony, you learn how to cope, you learn how to process pain, you learn how to articulate pain. As you saw, I can be emotional, I can cry, but I can still articulate myself. That's a skill. It's not something that just comes, because a couple of years ago, I may not have been able to have as an articulate conversation in relation to my emotions and where I sit with it, and also how I cope with that, with the pain of losing somebody that we were 18 months apart. We were best mates. We planned to go to Miami the summer that he died. My other siblings, I see them with their partners and, you know, getting houses. And I think of those things in relation to what I don't have them, you know, and that's been taken. So for me, you learn how to process and understand your pain. You learn how to put it in different, you have to put it in different files.
You learn how to live with it.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the only way that you can function.
Yeah.
Otherwise, to be fair, right, we when our auntie died, we went to like this support group, SAM, so support after murder and manslaughter, and we listened to some of the horrific stories in relation to people who, you know, families have been, you know, murdered and so on and so forth. And me and mum, not to, you know, diminish any of the experiences that people had, is we were obviously in pain because that's part of it, but there was also joy. And you know, me and my mum just laughing and joking, and some of the people couldn't understand it. They were like, how are you still able to be? And I'm like, well, you've got to choose yourself. You've got to make sure that, you know, you're living for something outside yourself. You've still got to help others. You don't want other people to go through what you've been through. So you've got to be active in terms of this change. You've got to love people. And that's hard, because people can be vile and disgusting, and Liverpool fans, they can be all these things, and you still got to love them anyway. Yeah. You know? So I think for me, dealing with all that, you will never, well, you know, when I think of everything I've lost, it does pain me, pains my soul in that respect. But then I think for these other people, you know, who can't, or, you know, people who do hate black people and don't want to see me thrive, I'm like, if you need me to prove my humanity, I'm not the one who's not human.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not the monster in that respect. And I love myself. I love my family, love my kids, love my city. Love, you know what I mean? I love being a Scouser. You know, for me, I'm more black Scouse and Jamaican than I'd say British in that respect. I'm Scouse. I'm black and Scouse. That's what I am. So, and I love that as part of my identity. It's a wealth of identity, because it's not just black. It's not just feminine. It's not just in silos. It's also working class. It's also the seeped in this history that this city. It's seeped in the work that I do. It's seeped in, you know, public and private sector, and working in the chat. It's seeped in all these things. You know, and that gives me and enables me to give a wealth of information to others. So in part, and I was talking to my partner about this the other day, was that even though it pains me to you know, I've lost my best mate, the wisdom that I can impart and the help that I can do for others, it doesn't compare, but it does help in terms of us keeping driving. And when if we go into, obviously, the Speak Out, Stop Hate campaign, when I sat with those young people, and after it, loads of them emailed me and was like, can you come on this podcast? Will you do this for me? Will you come and do this? And there was just an energy and a zeal and a want for change. And I just thought, this is why I do what I do. This is why I keep doing what I do, because I love people. I want to see people thrive, and I want to see definitively Liverpool allow, you know, and obviously the world, to allow people to just be free to be whoever it is that they want to be.
What do you think is coming, Dominique? Obviously last year was a big moment for mm-hmm. Black Lives Matter, in terms of hate crime, in terms of racism, in terms of those conversations we spoke about actually starting. Yeah. You know, I've seen change from within me, from within friends, from within yeah. white and black people mm-hmm. for the better. But I also kind of got my eyes opened a little bit in terms of I seen a couple of mates that I thought, hang on, is that what you think? Is that what you... But that led to conversations, which I presume then yeah. is a good thing. What's next in terms of that movement? And do we still need to be using that hashtag Black Lives Matter? Is it a hashtag you'd like to see go away? Is it something that we need to keep pushing?
For me... Yeah, Black Lives should matter and should continue to matter. Yes, we should use the hashtag. We should support an initiative that puts Black people at the centre of conversation, because we don't have conversations about Black people in this country. We don't. Unless it's attributed to, say, like, Ron Atney, to Stephen Lawrence, to, do you know what I mean? We do it in terms of the media. We're yet to have an honest conversation about race and race inequalities in this country, white, black, and brown, and then ethnic minorities as well. Because if we were ready to have those conversations, then we could talk about, for example, why Gypsy and Irish travel communities are some of the most deprived. Yeah, we could talk about how they don't fit into this acceptable form of what it means to be white. We could start, do you know what I mean, have those conversations. We need to get to a point where we start to have those conversations, and then we return what it means to be racist to its proper usage, to what it actually means. So we don't use it in a way that it freezes people for them doing something and then not and gets done. So you're a racist, and no, I'm not. They're not and gets done. Yeah. And we talk about it again. No, we talk about it in the essential sense that it's about institutionally generated inequality, right? Based on concepts of racial difference. That's what racism is. And then there's different types of racism. So you have an anti-Black racism, which is against Black people, and so on and so forth, yeah? And we don't do that. We don't talk about racist ideas. We don't talk about concepts where racial groups, a whole racial group is tarnished as this, and a whole racial group is that. And you know what I mean? We think when you think of the Rotherham scandal, the first thing people will think is Asian. That's wrong. It's racist. You know, we need to be quite definitive in the way that we talk about race and our understandings of race as well. And I think once we start to do that, that's how we become anti-racist. And being anti-racist ultimately is to start to have these dialogue, this conversation, but it's an active process of identifying and eliminating racism in the different systems and different environments that we're in. So if you, within your environment, within media, if you see that representation within your organization is not fair, do something about it. If you see that we don't have a race equality strategy, we don't have a strategy in terms of hate crime, we don't definitively work with organizations that don't look like us or don't, you know, are completely different, you know, you can definitively bring those things in. And that's how you change. Everybody has an individual responsibility in relation to being anti-racist, yeah? And this is part of it, is you can have, you know, even these conversations and people will watch it and hopefully people will go away and do the research, because Dominic can talk all this stuff and I could quote you loads of references. Go and do the work. It's part of being definitively part of the work. It's about being active and being in the world and then thinking.
What would you direct people to, Dominic? Sorry to jump in.
No, it's okay.
If you were thinking now, I do want to look into this. I do want to read more. I want to learn. What would you say? Because we've done loads of articles last year, 5 books you can read to be more inclusive, you know, that type of thing. Is there anything in particular you would say, go and have a look at this, go and watch that, go and see this?
There's loads, right? You know what, I can show you some. Okay. So you want to start doing this. Okay. So number one, Overcoming Everyday Racism. So this is by Susan Cummins, who's a doctor. And basically she talks about identity-based understandings of racism and the impact sociologically on racism and difference on people of colour. So Black, Asian, minority, ethnic people. But also there's activities in it that white people can do as well in order for them to understand their identity and their racial, white racial identities as well. So that's a good one to start with. Another one, which...
She's in a bookshelf.
I'm in the bookshelf. Anything by Kehinde Andrews. Now, most people see him as controversial because of the things that he says in relation to Blackness, and assertion in relation to Black identities in this country. But a lot of the things that he says are completely evidence-based and things that definitively need to be taken forward in relation to this country. So this is a good book as well. Akala's new book. There's also there's books about white racism that you can read about as well. So there's like Joe Fagan's book, who's based in the States as well. There's Lola Olofemi's Feminism Interrupted. That's another good book. And it talks more about feminism as being a way to obviously be definitive, but it can be applied to anti-racism practices as well. There's loads of stuff by Michael Rowe, Police Race and Racism. There's Paulo Freire, Pedagogy of the Oppressed. There's Bell Hooks. Bell Hooks has got stuff on whiteness. She's got stuff on Black feminist identities, talking back in relation to anti-racism as well. There's another one. This is a really good one on white privilege called by Kenwell Bopal. And she is a scholar based in the University of Birmingham, and she writes about obviously the myth of us being in a post-racial society. And she talks about different forms of racism, obviously, that are prevalent. Then she talks about the privileges in relation and also the non-attainable privileges that white people have, because it's not always economic. It's just about you not having to think about race. A really, really good book. And that's a British-focused book as well. For me, any Black feminist theorists, so Bell Hooks, Audre Lorde, there's Margaret Busby, and then some of your old stuff. So Paul Gilroy, Race and Nation, Paul Gilroy, After Empire. I could go on.
You know what? You are the most well-read person I've ever met in my life.
There's loads. Or, and if you don't want to read a book, you could go to the Runnymede Trust. Yeah, type in the Runnymede Trust. And definitively, they have loads of publication on inequalities in terms of race, class, education, everything. And they're a definitive think tank that work to help in terms of racial inequalities. Or if you want to be a little bit, you know, They want to do government-led, the Equality and Human Rights Commission as well. Some of their reports, like Heal in Britain, in terms of racial equality, there's a number of different reports. Or there's David Lammy's, the Racial Disparity Report, which is out 2017. And then there's State of a Nation as well. So that was written in 2020 by Omar Khan and some of the participants.
That was a big book last year, wasn't
it? Yeah. And that talked about racial inequalities right across health, immigration, criminal justice agencies. And then again, it's a dead accessible book for anybody, and it can be applied to a number of different deprived areas in our communities in order to support those who suffer from oppressions.
Listen, there's lots more as well on the Anthony Walker Foundation website, which is a great website if you haven't been on yet, just to keep up to date with what the guys are doing in terms of this brand new campaign as well. It's called Speak Out, Stop Hate. It launched last week. Get behind it, get involved in it. Another big drive from the Anthony Walker Foundation to stop hate crime. It's as simple as that. Dominique, what would you like to say? Your kind of closing comments, if you like, to anyone listening or watching right now about the campaign, about the future of the foundation, and your message to Liverpool, if you like.
For me, it's dead easy. Just don't be racist. Dead easy. Love, people who don't look like you. Be anti-racist and actively anti-racist. You know, being anti-racist is about arguing ideas that the racist policies that we have in structure are the cause of racial inequality. So being quite definitive in that, being actively anti-racist, you have to understand how racism affects the lives of Black and Brown and ethnic minority people in this country. You know, you have to have an understanding that racism is centuries deep. It didn't just turn up. Black Lives Matter didn't just plonk on our shoulders. And do you know what I mean? It's been around since 2014, but this notion of Black identities and Black people mattering in society is something that Malcolm X said, Martin Luther King said, Ida B. Wells said, that there's a number of different, there's like Claudia Johnson said back and these are all Black scholars in that respect. Darcus Howe said the reiterations of Black Lives Mattering is something that has been said for generations after generations and for years and years. And it's understanding that this is just another rally call for that. It's merely a declaration to say, listen, society continues to show that Black lives don't matter. So we are showing by solidarity, by being actively anti-racist, by trying to diminish and to dismantle structures of anti-racism in society, that Black lives actually do matter. And the only way that can come about is by getting rid of structures that centre whiteness, that centre, a Eurocentric, a non-diverse understandings of the world that we live in. When we know that it's diverse, we know that Black history is world history, we know and we understand the ramifications of empire today in 2021. Colonialism only stopped in 1997. Do you know what I mean? Like 1997. Yeah. So we need to have these quite stark, uncomfortable sometimes, but that's just life. Conversations about our position and our understanding of our own racial identities and those around us, because the key to well-being is understanding who we are and the impact that we have in others. When we start to decenter ourselves in that respect, and also to get rid of capitalism, I could go on in relation to that, patriarchal systems and systems of racism. When we start to get rid of all these different systems that we have in society, we can be free. It's as simple as that. We can be free to be whoever it is that you want to be, but it takes for us to be actively, we need to do something about it. So yes, if by the end of this, you follow the Anthony Walker Foundation, you get a couple of books, you actively, tell your friends when, they say things that are, are racist or prejudiced, you challenge them on those things. This is a start to how we change structures. But ultimately, we've got to go for the government as well in relation to changing some of these inequalities as well, because some of that lies there as well, and that comes down to us. But for me, working class solidarity is key, lad. That's key. It's key! And he might come after me for that, so I'm going to stop talking now.
Honestly, I could chat to you all day long. I just want your message to the city of Liverpool, Dominique, because no matter what's happened, it is a city that have kind of lived this story with you, with your mum, with your family since 2005. And watched you grow, you know, seeing your mum so many times talking about Anthony and about the foundation and the work that you've done since has been incredible. What would you like to say to Liverpool right now?
You know what? Yeah, for me, just continue to just do better. Continue to be actively anti-racist, support anti-racism organisations, support ethnic minority organisations, support organisations that help people in poverty, whether they are black, brown or white, and working class and in deprived communities. Support your local disabled charities, support your local women's refuge and so on and so forth. Actually love people, do you know what I mean? Like, one of the things I'll say for this city is we are not like any other people in this country. We're not. We are different. We've always been different. And we have a history that is seeped in fighting for injustice and fighting for the rights of people to just live. That's something that I know in terms of the history. You know, if we go to the Dockers, if we look at the understandings in relation to the Irish heritage in this city, and also the Christian understandings of this city, for a lot of people that shouldn't be difficult because it's ingrained in their fibre and their being. So for me, it's to thank the people of Liverpool for their continued support, but also to continue to be actively anti-racist and continue to love other people. And for me, that is, you know, as long as we do that, and we continue to do that, our kids will be sound. Things might not change in my 70 years or so that's left. But I'm hoping that the little things that we do, the individual things that we do, can help the cultures and the structures that are in place that cause these oppressions in society. And Scousers know that, you know. And for me, it's even like, when I speak to like the Hillsborough survivors and, you know, people whose families suffered in relation to the Dockers and stuff like that, and when I talk to people who've got Irish heritage and so on and so forth, I'm just like, you guys know injustice. You know what I mean? You live and breathe it. So this type of work, anti-racism work, is at the forefront of being a Scouser. So just be a Scouser and be proud in that respect, and definitively love on your people, and then also equally sort your team out. Like, do you know what I mean? Like Klopp. Yeah, like, you know what I mean? Like Klopp. Like, we can't use like his grief to talk about the bad form. We've got it definitively. You've got to show up. Like, Mane's got to show up, and he's phenomenal.
She forgets about this edit button. she really does. Dominique Walker, Anthony Walker Foundation, doing what you're doing, and we'll speak to you soon. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm.